It began as just another shift. A chilly November day. A sewer pipe beneath a suburban street. 22-year-old Brett Morrow had done this kind of job before, climbing into narrow, dark spaces with nothing but his training and the trust that someone had followed the safety rules. But on that day in Streamwood, Illinois, something went terribly wrong. He didn't come back up. The rescue team arrived fast, but not fast enough. Hours passed, cement hardened, time slowed, and when they finally reached Brett, he was already gone. What they found underground wasn't just a body. It was a buried truth. A trail of ignored protocols, corporate corner cutting, and warning signs no one wanted to see. Brett Morrow died doing his job. But the real cause of death? That's still up for debate, so if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Beneath the Surface. The morning of November 25th, 2017, broke with a cold indifference. Streamwood, Illinois was quiet, just another suburb waking up with coffee, weekend chores, and the hum of life moving as expected. But under the paved surface of Schaumburg Road, something else stirred. Something darker. Something irreversible. Brett Morrow, 22, stood outside the worksite rubbing his hands together for warmth. His breath formed quick clouds in the morning air. He wasn't new to this. Pipe relining, sewer access, confined spaces. He had worked for the contractor before. He was young, wiry, and known for taking tough jobs without complaint. His teammates jokingly called him the string bean, not just for his lean frame, but for his flexible attitude toward life and work. He climbed down that manhole with his usual calm. He didn't know it would be his last descent. The job seemed routine. Install a fiberglass liner inside the deteriorating sewer pipe, a procedure called cured-in-place piping. The process involved inflating a resin-soaked liner and curing it with steam or hot water until it hardened. But this pipe wasn't new. It was old, irregular, and 20 feet underground, the kind of space that required strict adherence to confined space entry protocols, oxygen monitors, entry permits, retrieval lines. But those protocols were flexible. At least they were for the contractor. The company had deadlines, and Streamwood's Public Works Department had already expressed concerns about delays. Brett was told to enter and check the liner placement. It would be quick, no big deal. No one seemed to notice that the clock was already ticking. Up on the surface, the crew passed around coffee and shifted their weight, waiting for Brett's confirmation call. But minutes stretched. Then radio silence. A foreman called down. No answer. Another worker peered in, shouted. Still nothing. Panic didn't set in immediately. There was a sense of disbelief, the way you look for a dropped phone before realizing it's missing. But eventually, someone acknowledged the unspoken truth. Brett was trapped. Calls were made. Fire rescue units scrambled. A confined space rescue protocol was triggered. But precious time had already been lost. As the Streamwood Fire Department arrived, they found an unholy mess. Resin fumes. A narrow, inaccessible pipe. No oxygen lines. No visible signs of life. The fiberglass liner had already been activated, its hardening process underway. What should have been a monitored, staged entry had become a death trap. They couldn't even see him. A rescue team suited up, lowered breathing tanks, scanners, and cameras. It was 10 a.m. Brett had entered just before 9 a.m. By 2 p.m., there was still no contact. By 5 p.m., they weren't calling it a rescue anymore. They were calling it a recovery. Brett's father, Michael, had received the call around noon. There's been an accident. No one gave him details. No one told him it involved confined spaces, or fiberglass curing resin, or that his son had been down there alone. He arrived on site and was held behind caution tape, watching strangers try to reach his only son. "It's going to be okay," someone had told him. It wasn't. Inside the pipe, Brett's fate had likely been sealed within the first few minutes. The resin released toxic fumes as it cured, robbing the air of oxygen. OSHA would later determine the environment was immediately dangerous to life and health. But there were no retrieval lines, no standby attendant actively monitoring the entry, and no emergency ventilation system. When firefighters finally reached Brett just after 10 p.m., they found him motionless. His body was pinned awkwardly by the now hardened liner. He had suffocated, alone, in the dark, beneath a town that never heard his screams. He was pronounced dead at the scene. The media arrived just before midnight. News vans parked, cameras clicked, lights flashed, but the headlines didn't last. A local paper ran a short piece. Worker dies in sewer pipe. No deep dive, no outrage, no call for answers. Because Brett Morrow wasn't a celebrity, he wasn't rich, he was just a kid with a job, doing what someone told him to do, and when the resin set and the news cycle moved on, his story faded too. But not for his family. Not for the firefighters who tried to save him. Not for those who knew what really happened and chose to stay quiet. In the days that followed, OSHA arrived. So did lawyers. The company issued a statement of condolence. The family was told it was an unfortunate accident. But accidents have patterns, and this one had been building for years. Warnings ignored. Safety shortcuts normalized. Profits prioritized over protocols. And a boy, because that's what he still was, paid the price. Somewhere in Brett's childhood room, his rugby jersey still hangs. His helmet sits dusty on a shelf. His mother keeps it clean. His younger sister leaves a light on, even when she's not home. The hole in the ground was eventually covered. The job was completed. The pipe works fine. But if you drive past that stretch of road today, there's no marker, no sign, just pavement. Just silence. Chapter 2. The safety they skipped. The morning after Brett Morrow's death, a different kind of silence settled over the Streamwood Public Works site. The air was colder. The crews were smaller. No machinery hummed. Yellow tape still circled the manhole, but the real damage wasn't visible from the surface. What had been buried the night before was more than just a young worker. It was a system-wide failure. One that no one wanted to talk about. At least not yet. Brett's body had barely cooled when OSHA began its formal inquiry. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration dispatched investigators trained in confined space fatalities. They'd seen similar stories. Men sent underground without monitors, companies skipping entry permits, cheap masks passed off as enough. But something about this one felt different. There was a sense, not of freak accident, but of inevitability. The company responsible, a subcontractor hired to repair aging sewer lines using cured-in-place pipe technology, had already prepared its first press release. A tragic accident, they called it. Unforeseen. Unpreventable. But OSHA's team found their first red flag in less than 20 minutes. There was no confined space entry permit. According to federal law, any time a worker enters a permit-required confined space, like a sewer pipe, they must follow strict procedures, test for oxygen and toxic gases, assign an entry attendant, use lifelines and retrieval systems, and document every step. In Brett's case, none of those steps had been documented. In fact, the supervisor on site admitted there had been no formal safety briefing at all. The hard truth? Brett had been sent in blind. In interviews with crew members, investigators uncovered more. One worker, who asked to remain anonymous, admitted they often worked without air monitors. "We're in and out so fast, what's the point?" he said. Another mentioned that management frowned on delays. "Every extra hour we spend down there costs money. They want it cured and cleared." It wasn't malicious. It was cultural. A culture of shortcuts. A culture of just get it done. And Brett, fresh-faced and eager to prove himself, trusted them. He trusted his supervisors. He trusted the training. He believed, like most young workers do, that someone was watching his back. But no one was. By the end of the first week, OSHA had compiled over a dozen serious violations. The worst? Failure to provide emergency rescue procedures for confined space work. In other words, if something went wrong, which it did, there was no plan. And yet, despite the evidence piling up, the company pushed back. They insisted Brett was experienced, that he'd gone in voluntarily, that the crew did the best they could. But behind closed doors, something else was happening. The insurance attorneys had arrived. The silence was about to become legally binding. Back in Gurney, Brett's parents were spiraling. His mother, Elena, had stopped sleeping. She couldn't stop replaying the moment the firefighters came to her door. She asked them again and again, was he scared? Did he call for help? Did he suffer? They said he likely lost consciousness early. They didn't say what they saw when they pulled him out. His father, Michael, was less interested in comfort. He wanted answers. He started making calls, filing public records requests, speaking with reporters, though few returned his messages. The bigger outlets had already moved on. A local accident, no criminal charges, no scandal, just another workplace fatality. But Michael refused to let Brett become a footnote. He wrote to lawmakers, he attended city council meetings, he began gathering other families who had lost loved ones in industrial accidents, and slowly, quietly, a picture began to form. This wasn't about one pipe, one mistake. It was about an industry. Cured-in-place pipelining. CIPP is considered trenchless technology, a cost-saving, efficient way to rehabilitate old pipes without digging up roads, but the process involves high-pressure steam, chemical resins, and narrow access points. In 2017 alone, at least 14 workers in the U.S. died in trenchless repair-related incidents. Most were young. Most were untrained, and most lacked adequate safety equipment. But the companies that performed the work? They made millions. Streamwood had contracted the job as part of a broader infrastructure upgrade, a necessary project. But when towns award bids, they often select the lowest cost. And cost-cutting has consequences, especially when those cuts are invisible, 20 feet below ground. The fire chief who oversaw Brett's recovery, Tom Castillo, later admitted in a private debrief that his team was not adequately equipped for the situation. "We're trained for confined spaces," he said, "but this wasn't a standard rescue. The liner had hardened. We were cutting through cement. It was like trying to carve a body out of a coffin." His men had nightmares for months. Some still do, but they were never given counseling. No critical incident debrief. Just the next call. The next body. Meanwhile, the town remained quiet. No public memorial was held. No plaque placed. Just a subtle nod in a monthly council report. Brett Morrow, 22nd. Deceased during contracted sewer repair. Closed. But behind the scenes, the legal machine had only begun to churn. The contractor's legal team worked to minimize liability. OSHA fines were negotiated. A civil settlement was quietly offered to the Morrow family, undisclosed terms, with the standard gag order. But Michael Morrow wasn't signing anything. He wanted court. He wanted press. He wanted the world to know his son didn't die because of bad luck. He died because someone decided safety was optional. At the end of that second week, Elena stood alone in Brett's room. His boots still sat by the door. His high school rugby photo leaned against the window, crooked. She reached for it, then stopped. Her fingers trembled. Not from grief, but from rage. Someone had to answer for this. Because Brett Morrow had done everything right. And he still ended up dead in a pipe with no air. Chapter 3. Paper Trails and Payouts. Michael Morrow sat alone at the kitchen table, a manila folder open in front of him. The edges were worn from too much handling. Inside were printed emails, safety regulation PDFs, and a printed copy of the OSHA citation. Each line underlined, highlighted, annotated in red ink. Across the table, Elena watched him with quiet exhaustion. She knew what that folder meant. Not just Brett's story, but a war. And Michael Morrow wasn't backing down. The OSHA report had landed like a punch to the gut. 14 citations, 7 categorized as serious, 1 classified as willful, meaning the employer knowingly failed to comply with legal requirements. The most damning line was cold and simple. Employer failed to ensure a safe means of entry and rescue from confined space. Translation: they sent Brett in with no way out. But citations alone don't change laws, or save lives, or stop it from happening again. For that, someone has to pay, and not just in dollars. Michael had worked blue-collar jobs most of his life. He wasn't naive about how companies operated. He knew what cost-cutting looked like. He knew what corners got sliced when deadlines loomed, but he didn't expect those shortcuts to kill his son. And now, the company was lawyering up and laying low. The settlement offer came quietly. It was more money than Michael had seen at once in his life, but it came with conditions: non-disclosure, non-disparagement, and a full release of liability. It was the same playbook companies always used in these situations. Pay to bury the noise. Pay to rewrite the ending. Elena wanted peace. Michael wanted justice. They didn't sign. Meanwhile, the contractor's insurance company was working overtime. Their PR team had issued a vague statement expressing deep sympathy for the Morrow family, while subtly emphasizing Brett's voluntary entry into the pipe. The implication was clear. Brett took the risk. Brett made the call. The company simply supported the work. But that narrative began to crack. One of Brett's co-workers, a 19-year-old apprentice named Jason Alvarez, spoke to a local reporter off the record. What he said blew holes through the official story. "Brett didn't want to go in," Jason claimed. "He said it wasn't safe. The gas monitor was beeping earlier that morning. The boss told him to reset it." Reset it, not fix it, not investigate. Just silence the alarm and get in the pipe. The reporter couldn't publish without a named source, but the quote found its way to Michael. It gave him fuel. Because if Jason was telling the truth, then Brett wasn't just a victim. He was a sacrificial lamb, pressured into a deadly space by men who knew the risks and did it anyway. Michael decided to file a wrongful death lawsuit. It was a bold move. Few families win those cases, especially against well-insured contractors with airtight legal defenses. But Michael didn't care. The suit wasn't just about money. It was about getting it all on record. He wanted subpoenas, depositions, testimonies under oath. He wanted names. So he hired an attorney, not one of the TV commercial guys, a former federal prosecutor who had worked labor safety cases. She warned him it would be a long fight. That discovery would be brutal, that the company would come for his credibility, twist his grief, weaponize it. He nodded. "Let them try." In the process of building the case, the attorney uncovered something worse. This wasn't the first time. 2 years earlier, the same contractor had been cited in a different state for another confined space violation. A worker had passed out due to lack of oxygen. He'd survived, barely, and settled quietly. That case, too, was sealed under NDA. It was a pattern, and OSHA had let them keep operating. Even more troubling, one of the project inspectors in Streamwood had flagged the worksite 3 days before Brett's death for lack of visible safety protocol. But no follow-up was documented. Michael read that line over and over. 3 days. Someone saw it, someone knew, and nothing happened. He felt like he couldn't breathe. At the same time, Streamwood officials began dodging calls. City council meetings became more tightly managed. Questions submitted by residents, many organized by Michael, were skipped over or answered vaguely. Ongoing litigation became the town's favorite phrase, but the town had awarded the contract, and the town had oversight responsibility. The deeper Michael dug, the more he realized how systemic the failure had been. Even the fire department, praised publicly for their effort, had made critical mistakes. The delay in declaring a confined space emergency, the miscommunication between agencies, the lack of specialized equipment on hand, everyone had a piece of this. But no one wanted to hold it. Months passed. Michael kept pushing. Elena, too, found her voice, writing letters to state representatives, appearing on local radio, organizing a memorial walk for construction workers who died on the job. Their story began to circulate online, picked up by labor watchdog blogs, shared in union circles, whispered in safety inspector groups. Still, no mainstream coverage. The tragedy was too small, the scandal too quiet. It wasn't until a second worker in a nearby town died under similar circumstances that the media returned. This time, they connected the dots. Brett Morrow's name was finally back in the news. A year after Brett's death, the lawsuit moved to discovery. Depositions revealed internal emails from the contractor's leadership, one in particular that stopped Michael cold. If they follow the checklist, it'll take 2 days. If they just get in and line it, we're done by lunch. The email was dated the morning of Brett's death. It was all the proof he needed. Someone had made a choice. Someone had calculated the risk. And someone assumed no one would notice if a worker died underground. By now, the company had rebranded. New logo, new name, same leadership. But Michael wasn't chasing them for revenge. He wanted them exposed, and more importantly, he wanted legislation. If his son's death could change even one rule, one policy, one town's protocol, then Brett wouldn't have died in vain. The payout didn't matter anymore. He was building something bigger, a reckoning. Chapter 4. What the camera missed. The footage was grainy, a fixed security camera perched on a nearby utility pole, installed not by the contractor, but by the town's traffic monitoring program, captured a wide-angle view of the worksite that morning. It didn't see faces, it didn't hear voices, but what it caught, frame by frame, was damning. It showed Brett descending into the manhole. Alone? No harness, no tripod retrieval system, no standby attendant anchored to a lifeline. Just a young man in a high-visibility vest, lowering himself into a pipe that would become his tomb. The footage also showed something else. Two men, supervisors, standing nearby, glancing at their watches. The timestamp read 8:53 a.m. By 8:56, Brett was out of view. By 9:12, one of them walked back to the work truck and made a call. Less than 2 minutes later, the camera caught the subtle flicker of emergency lights. But no one climbed down to check. No one even tried. When Michael's lawyer acquired the footage, she froze it at 8:53. There he was, Brett, mid-motion, half suspended in air, legs still visible above the manhole. She enlarged the image and printed it, framing it for Michael. He didn't know whether to cry or scream. It was the last proof of life. Everything after that was shadows and silence. Investigators had asked during early interviews why Brett went down alone. The company's safety officer, brought in after the incident, claimed it was standard procedure under time-sensitive conditions, that Brett was fully aware of the environment, and that the crew didn't observe any immediate hazard. But the footage contradicted everything. No oxygen testing was visible. No one was monitoring his air quality. No one even checked a clock to see how long he'd been down there, because this wasn't a rescue plan. It was a countdown. Back at the fire station, Chief Castillo sat reviewing the incident timeline once more. He had lived this day 100 times. His department had responded to dozens of emergencies, but this one still stuck to his ribs. The part that haunted him most wasn't the initial call. It was the 2-hour gap between the moment Brett stopped responding and the moment the fire department was officially dispatched. 2 hours. In confined space rescues, that's an eternity. Most victims die in minutes. Suffocation, toxic gas, heat stroke. 2 hours meant they weren't even trying to save him. They were managing a problem. When Castillo asked to review the company's internal emergency response log, he was met with silence. Then lawyers, then denials. The logs were either not retained or not relevant to current litigation. But someone in the department leaked a screenshot. It was an internal text between 2 project managers. Just tell them he was moving when they lost contact. No timestamp, no context. But the implication was clear. Build a story, soften the blow, make it seem like it wasn't their fault. But everyone involved knew that was a lie. In the months that followed, as Michael pushed for criminal charges, he found himself sitting in the office of a state labor investigator, a woman named Dana Klein, who had seen far too many cases like Brett's. She leaned forward, hands clasped. "I want to be honest with you," she said. "This isn't rare. We just rarely get this much proof." Michael blinked. "You mean there are more?" Dana nodded. "Dozens, sometimes more each year. They're almost always settled quietly. The families take the money, the contractors vanish and reopen under new names, and unless there's a death on camera or a whistleblower goes public, it never sticks." He exhaled, slow and heavy. "So you're saying there's nothing I can do?" She paused, then handed him a thin folder. "Not nothing, but you'll have to go above us, above state." Inside the folder were names: journalists, senators, labor advocacy groups, whistleblower lawyers, a long shot, but a map. If Michael wanted this to change, he'd have to burn the whole thing down in public. The next step was the media, and this time, Michael wouldn't rely on sympathy. He had proof. The footage, the OSHA violations, the text message, the deposition transcripts. He packaged it all into a digital folder and sent it to every news outlet, labor blog, and podcast host he could find. For weeks, no one replied. Until one did. A podcast producer from a show called Fault Line agreed to record an episode. It wasn't national, but it had reach, and it had bite. They interviewed Michael, Elena, Brett's coach, and even Jason Alvarez, the young apprentice who had witnessed the beeping gas monitor and been told to ignore it. The episode dropped 3 days later. It went viral. 10s of thousands listened in the first 24 hours. And for the first time, Brett's name began to trend, not as a victim, but as a symbol. A symbol of corporate silence, of government failure, of how easily the working class gets buried, literally and metaphorically. Social media erupted. Labor unions picked it up. Senators issued cautious tweets. And OSHA, caught flat-footed, released a second statement reaffirming their commitment to worker safety. It was too little, too late. But it was movement. The town of Streamwood finally held a public meeting, not because they wanted to, because they had to. Dozens of residents showed up. Some brought homemade signs, others just wore black. Elena Morrow stood at the podium. Her voice didn't shake. My son's death wasn't a tragedy, she said. It was a decision. Someone decided to cut corners. Someone decided safety was negotiable. And someone decided that our pain would disappear quietly. She paused, looked out over the silent room. But we're not disappearing. The next day, Michael got a call from a state legislator's office. They wanted to draft a bill. Brett's Law, they called it, focused on strengthening enforcement for confined space entry regulations and increasing fines for willful violations. It wasn't justice, but it was a start, and it had his son's name on it. Chapter 5. The Contractor's Game. By the time the public knew Brett Morrow's name, the company that sent him underground had changed theirs. It was a subtle rebrand. New colors, a polished logo, a shortened name that dropped the legacy of lawsuits like old baggage. On paper, they were still the same entity, same office, same executive board, same silent owners. But the name shift was strategic. Google searches for Brett Morrow death wouldn't lead to them anymore. It was just business. They had survived worse. Behind closed doors, the contractor's legal team worked like clockwork. Their goal was singular: minimize exposure. They had learned from previous incidents. The company had faced OSHA citations before, smaller cases, quieter deaths, but had always paid fines, settled with families, and returned to work. This time, though, things weren't fading. The podcast episode had gone viral. A growing group of labor advocates had begun organizing a petition. A local newspaper editor published a searing editorial, "When Profits Bury People." And then came a letter from a congresswoman calling for a federal review of confined space standards across the industry. This was not going away. So the company did what companies do when under fire. They played defense and offense. The first step? Discredit the family. Their attorneys filed a motion questioning Michael Morrow's emotional stability, citing his aggressive social media posts and confrontational tone during interviews. They called him obsessed, unhinged, and motivated by personal vendetta rather than facts. It didn't land well. Public reaction backfired. The motion was quietly withdrawn. Next, they turned on their own. Three employees were terminated, Jason Alvarez among them. The official reason was restructuring, but insiders knew it was retaliation. Jason had spoken publicly. He had exposed the truth about the gas monitor, the ignored warnings, the casual safety violations. He was a liability now. The contractor even threatened him with a defamation suit. But Jason didn't back down. He lawyered up and began building his own case. Suddenly, the company was under attack from both sides. Then came the real shock. Emails leaked, not just internal safety memos, but communications with the town of Streamwood. One email, dated 2 weeks before Brett's death, revealed that a city official had flagged the contractor for repeated procedural inconsistencies and lack of documented safety compliance. The response? Noted, but we're on a tight timeline. Let's get through phase one before raising flags. The town had known. They'd looked the other way, and Brett had died in that silence. As this new information reached the public, calls for accountability grew louder. Streamwood's mayor issued a press statement calling the situation deeply unfortunate and promising a full internal review. It meant nothing. No resignations followed, no disciplinary action. The town attorney claimed that since the contractor was an independent entity, the municipality bore no legal responsibility. But the court of public opinion had already decided. This was a cover-up. Inside the contractor's boardroom, panic finally set in. Profits were falling. Cities were canceling bids. And labor unions had begun blacklisting the company. They had weathered lawsuits before. But this one was bleeding them slowly, Not in millions of dollars, but in trust, in reputation, in future work. So they launched a new strategy. Co-opt the narrative. A senior executive gave an exclusive interview with a corporate-friendly news outlet. In it, he described the incident as heartbreaking and claimed the company had since invested millions in new safety initiatives. He praised Brett as a promising young man and offered condolences to the family. It was scripted damage control. The interviewer didn't ask about the deleted safety logs, or the rebranding, or the leaked emails. They weren't supposed to. But Michael Morrow watched the interview. So did Elena, and so did thousands of people who now knew better. The comments section exploded with outrage. Where was this concern when he was buried alive? You don't get to claim him now. Say his name. Say Brett Morrow. The clip made its way to the union circuit, and then to Faultline, the podcast that had started it all. They aired a follow-up episode titled The Contractor's Game, and in it, they dismantled the company's PR playbook, line by line, with receipts. Meanwhile, in a federal labor oversight office in D.C., a staffer was reading a growing stack of formal complaints. Over 3,000 signatures now supported a congressional hearing into Brett's case and others like it. An intern, scrolling through social media, played a video clip of Brett's sister. She stood on a small stage at a workers' memorial event, holding up a photo of her brother. "He wasn't a martyr," she said. "He was just doing his job. But now his name is being used by the same people who let him die. Don't let them rewrite this story." The crowd went quiet. Some cried. The contractor's last card was the courtroom. Their lawyers tried to force a settlement one last time, this time with a larger figure. Enough to tempt, enough to silence. Michael and Elena declined. They were never in this for a payout. They were in it for something no money could buy. The truth. And if that meant going to trial, then so be it. They'd already been through hell. What was a courtroom compared to a coffin? Chapter 6, The Trial for the Living. The courthouse in Cook County wasn't built for justice. It was built for process. Gray concrete, fluorescent lights, air that smelled like damp paper and sweat. But as Michael and Elena Morrow stepped through its doors, hand in hand, it felt like a reckoning. Not just for them, but for every worker who'd ever been told to just get in the hole. The courtroom itself was unremarkable. Rows of wooden benches, a flickering clock above the judge's bench, microphones that made everyone sound flat and far away. But the people seated inside? They were the story. Reporters, union reps, family members of other victims, off-duty firefighters, and Jason Alvarez, seated in the second row, jaw set, eyes forward. He'd shaved, wore a borrowed suit. He didn't smile. This wasn't a funeral. It was a fight. The case was officially a wrongful death suit against the contractor. But everyone in the room knew it was bigger than that. The Morrow family had refused settlement after settlement. They had released audio from depositions, video footage, OSHA documents, even portions of the town's email correspondence. Public interest was at an all-time high. The outcome of this case could influence policy across the entire construction industry. Still, they were the plaintiffs, and the burden of proof was theirs to carry. The contractor's defense was as predictable as it was infuriating. They painted Brett as an experienced worker who made a personal decision to enter the pipe. They called him motivated, independent, even heroic, language crafted to evoke sympathy while distancing themselves from responsibility. They argued that all required equipment had been available, that no one forced Brett to enter, that what happened was a tragic, unforeseeable accident. But Michael's legal team had come prepared, and they had the receipts. The prosecution's case unfolded like a controlled explosion. First came the footage. The wide-angle camera feed showing Brett descending the manhole alone. No safety harness, no backup team, no air monitor in hand. Then the emails, internal and municipal, confirming that safety concerns had been flagged and ignored. Then Jason Alvarez, calm and unwavering on the stand. "They told him to reset the gas monitor," he said. "It was beeping. He said he didn't feel good about going in. The boss told him to stop stalling, so he went." The courtroom was still. No one moved. The defense attempted to shake Jason, tried to paint him as disgruntled, inexperienced, possibly even vengeful. But the jury wasn't buying it. Jason had no reason to lie. In fact, he'd lost his job for telling the truth. When the prosecution introduced the leaked text message, "Just tell them he was moving when they lost contact," the air left the room. It was the first time Elena allowed herself to cry in court. She didn't wipe her face. She let the jury see every tear. Next came the fire chief, Tom Castillo, reluctant, haunted, but honest. "We arrived late," he said. "Not because we dragged our feet, but because we weren't called early enough. When we got there, the situation was already unrecoverable." He explained the technical details, the resin's toxicity, the lack of oxygen, the absence of an emergency retrieval plan. "By the time we reached him," Castillo said quietly, "he'd likely been gone for hours." His voice broke on the last word. No one blamed him. But everyone heard him. The town of Streamwood was not a named party in the trial, but their absence became its own kind of evidence. Emails showed they'd ignored warnings, opted for low-cost bids, failed to conduct proper oversight. The jury didn't need a verdict to see it. The public did. And outside, protesters had started lining up. Not loud, not violent, just present. Holding signs that read, "Say his name, Brett Morrow." Safety isn't optional. One death, one law. The movement had outgrown the courtroom. On the seventh day of trial, Michael took the stand. He didn't bring notes. He didn't need them. "My son trusted them," he said. "He thought someone had his back. He thought the rules mattered. He didn't know the rules only mattered when it was convenient." He paused. "I'm not here for revenge. I'm here because I want the next father to know. When his son goes to work, he'll come home, not in a box." Silence followed. Then applause. The judge struck it from the record, but it didn't matter. The message had landed. Closing arguments were delivered on a Friday morning. The contractor's team warned of a dangerous precedent. They claimed the case was built on emotion, not facts. They warned of job losses and company collapse. The Morrow family's attorney responded with a single line. "What is one life worth, if not a company's truth?" The jury deliberated for just under 5 hours. They returned a unanimous verdict. Liable. The contractor was ordered to pay $11.2 million in damages. It wouldn't bring Brett back. But it shattered the silence. That night, Elena stood on her porch and looked up at the sky. There were no stars, just the faint hum of a nearby streetlight. But for the first time since Brett's death, she felt something like peace. Not because the fight was over, but because someone finally said it out loud. This should never have happened. Chapter 7. The Legacy They Can't Bury. 6 months after the verdict, a weathered brass plaque was quietly installed on a concrete sidewalk in Streamwood, Illinois, just steps from the manhole where Brett Morrow died. It read, "In memory of Brett Morrow, 1995-2017. A son, a brother, a worker who deserved better. May no one enter darkness without a path back to the light. No ribbon cutting. No mayoral speech. just a quiet morning. A handful of construction workers who came on their day off, and Brett's family, shoulders tight but heads high. Elena ran her hand across the plaque's edge. Michael stood behind her, arms crossed, a tremble hidden in the way he clenched his jaw. Neither spoke. They didn't need to. The silence said enough. Brett was no longer just a statistic. His story had become a warning etched in metal, in memory, and, perhaps most importantly, in law. Brett's law passed unanimously in the Illinois state legislature 2 months after the trial concluded. The bill, spurred by public outcry and media pressure, strengthened existing confined space labor regulations. It mandated real-time oxygen level monitoring for all underground entries, emergency retrieval systems in place before descent, mandatory third-party safety audits for high-risk contractors, criminal liability for supervisors who knowingly violate safety protocols. It was more than symbolic. It had teeth. And it bore Brett's name. When the governor signed it, he looked into the camera and said, "This is for every worker who ever wondered if safety ends where the contract begins. Not anymore." The room erupted in applause. Michael didn't clap. He just exhaled, like he'd been holding his breath for years. In the months that followed, ripples spread far beyond Illinois. Other states introduced similar legislation. Labor unions adopted stricter internal reporting policies. The U.S. Department of Labor re-examined its enforcement budget, and for the first time in decades, OSHA's annual funding saw a notable increase. Brett's death had changed things. Not enough, but something. The contractor, buried under the weight of the verdict and public backlash, folded by year's end. Its executives quietly moved on, some to smaller firms, others out of the industry entirely. One, under mounting pressure, issued a handwritten apology to the Morrow family. Michael tore it in half without reading it. Forgiveness wasn't required for closure. Just truth. Elena started a non-profit, the Morrow Foundation, dedicated to worker safety advocacy and grief support for families affected by industrial fatalities. She traveled to community colleges, trade schools, union halls. She brought Brett's story everywhere she went. She spoke softly, with grace, but there was steel in her message. "You don't have to die to do your job right." She turned pain into purpose, and people listened. Jason Alvarez finished trade school and took a job with a union-backed firm that prioritized safety. He now teaches a confined space safety course once a month. The first slide in his presentation is a photo of Brett, helmet on, smile half-formed, just a kid who trusted the system. "I tell every student the same thing," Jason says. "If you feel something's off, don't go in. Because Brett Morrow did everything right, except walk away." The podcast that helped revive Brett's story, Fault Line, won a Peabody Award that year. In their acceptance speech, the host said, "We didn't tell this story to be heroes. We told it because someone buried the truth, and Brett deserved more than silence." The plaque in Streamwood gleamed faintly behind them on the screen. At home, Elena keeps Brett's room exactly as it was. The rugby photo, the boots, the folded college acceptance letter he never got to answer. Sometimes she sits in the doorway, tea in hand, eyes wet but unblinking. She doesn't speak to him out loud. Not anymore. But sometimes, when the wind creaks through the hallway, she swears she hears his voice. Just a whisper. Just enough. Michael, now a reluctant figurehead in the world of worker advocacy, never imagined his life would end up here. He still doesn't like cameras, still winces when strangers recognize him. But he keeps showing up, at hearings, at panels, at gravesides of workers lost after Brett. because if he doesn't show up, who will? The silence comes back so fast. The legacy Brett Morrow left behind wasn't about heroism. He didn't set out to change laws. He didn't ask to be a symbol. He just wanted to do his job and come home. And because he didn't, because a system failed him, everything changed. Not enough, but something. And sometimes something is how it starts.